this has been a racial divide for a very long time, all of our lives. So there's a something that happened to me in the courtroom one time, and the DA asked me what I do when I get up in the morning. I said, I pray. Then I asked him, did he pray? And he said, sometimes. And I laughed. And he said, did you find humor in that? I say, no, it goes back to something the old man told me one time. He say, son, even the devil prays sometimes. So if you see someone that really needs help, they may accept that help, but does that change their heart? At the end of the day, I would pray that it would change the hearts of the individuals. But we just know that they're in need of help, and we have always been a helping people, Dave. So, yes, we are helping each other. Yes, it seems to be a unity because everybody is in need. And believe me, this flood has affected more of the white areas of Baton Rouge than it have the black areas. So they're definitely 14, 15 feet underwater. They're still underwater. Inside of the urban community, the water has gone out. So we are repairing while they're still in despair. So definitely, man, everybody is trying to work together. But will that stay there? I don't know. That remains to be seen. You know, after 9-1-1, we had that same unity all over America, and then it went back to being like it was. So it's just a waiting game, Dave, is what I can say.
Silky Slim, we appreciate you taking time out and informing us and giving us the real insight as to what is going on the ground in Louisiana and Baton Rouge. We will stay in touch, and those pictures, I think, tell the story, and we'll try and post it up on our website so people can see. This is pretty bad, just as bad as Katrina in terms of this flooding. 40,000 homes have been destroyed in Baton Rouge, and I hope people can sit with that, as well as sit with the fact that you have a governor that sits there that had been advocating that money be kept away from the people. So let's think about that. And Silky, thank you very much.
Man, thank you for having me, Dave. Thank you.
In 1964, a handful of determined classical music and jazz enthusiasts put their passion and engineering skills together to create Portland, Oregon's first community radio station. 4 years later, in 1968, KABU was born. After 48 years, KABU Community Radio is still very much a thriving media hub for Portland and beyond. 2018 will mark 50 years, and KABU is planning a long line of celebrations now. We need your help. Our top four goals to get started are fundraising, Oregon Historical Society exhibit building, sharing stories in history, and events in celebration. For more information, contact volunteer at kboo.org or Armando Gonzalez at mandosmundo@yahoo.com. We look forward to your help.
It's 6:02 p.m. here at KBOO Portland. It's time for Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio. This is Jamie Partridge, your host. Tonight we'll be hearing excerpts from a talk on socialists, unions, and the rank and file given at the 2015 Socialism Conference in Chicago.
Our first speaker today is Chris Misano. He's a staffer for Ask Me District Council 37 in New York City. He's also a contributing editor to Jacobin. And finally is Larry Bradshaw, a longtime ISO member in the Bay Area and the vice president of SEIU Local 1021.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you to all of you for coming. As late as 2008, it wasn't unreasonable to think that the stars were aligning for a long-awaited revitalization of the U.S. labor movement. The financial crisis focused popular anger on the Wall Street bankers, whose activities brought the economy to the brink of collapse. The election of Barack Obama and Democratic majorities in both houses of Congress raised our hopes for the passage of a robust economic recovery program and long-sought labor reforms. And it seemed as if workers themselves were finally willing to take action against the decades-long trend of increasing corporate power and inequality. The occupation of the Republic windows and doors plan here in Chicago by a militant UE local, an action that drew approving notice from both the president-elect and much of the public, electrified our ranks and seemed to echo FDR's support for unionization and collective bargaining during the New Deal. So to me and to a lot of other people, this appeared to be the most favorable set of circumstances for the US labor movement in decades, and the first significant hope for revitalization since the successful Teamsters strike against UPS in 1997. But it didn't happen. Labor law reform was sidelined in favor of health care reform, and the Republicans rolled up big electoral wins at all levels in 2010 and 2014. Despite that popular anger at the multi-trillion dollar bank bailouts, the financial sector came out of the crisis stronger than ever. Corporate profits are at record levels, inequality keeps increasing, et cetera, et cetera. We're seeing some new signs of militancy among fast food and retail workers. They've succeeded in raising minimum wages in a number of states and cities across the country. Still, private sector unionization continues to move towards total collapse. And in the public sector, the labor movement's last stronghold, the state-level attacks on collective bargaining rights and anti-union cases in the judicial system have, unfortunately, set the stage for a pretty decisive offensive against organized working-class power in this country. So between those efforts to pass right-to-work laws at the state and local level, legal challenges like Harris v. Quinn and now Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association, it seems like the legal institutional basis of trade unions in the U.S. is being dismantled. Once that's lost, if it is lost, it will be incredibly difficult to bring unions back as they were before. So today I want to address three issues and problems that labor activists with a rank and file orientation will probably face during what is likely to be a difficult and disorienting period of transition. So one, first, the legal institutional framework surrounding the US labor movement is likely to change radically and pretty soon. Two, labor activists with a militant rank and file orientation need to be prepared to confront the likely responses of our antagonists within the labor movement. And then third, the immediate impacts will be harsh, but in the longer run, perhaps there will be some new opportunities for people like us in this room to advance a new vision of working class power and organization in the US. So first, how many people in the room have heard of this case, Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association? That's fantastic, because I actually find that a lot of people in and around labor, even today, have not heard of this case, which is pretty terrifying. So since most of you seem to know about it, for the few of you that don't, Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association is a lawsuit coming out of California in which a right-wing teacher supported by various right-wing legal organizations has filed suit against her union. Basically, what they're seeking is to abolish the agency shop in the public sector and institute a right-to-work regime in all 50 states. The Supreme Court agreed to hear that case like a week ago. It will be argued in the next term. Within the next 12 months, we could get a right-to-work regime across the entire public sector in all 50 states. The case is the culmination of a decades-long project to dismantle organized working-class power in the U.S. It's possible that the court will decide not to reverse that 1977 Abood decision that the agency shop is based on, and I think Larry's going to talk a little bit about this in his talk. They could decide to just leave it alone. But the fact that at least four justices are willing to hear this case does not seem to me to be a very good sign. And I think that it's pretty likely that within the next 12 months we could be facing a right-to-work regime everywhere. In the short run, the impact of what's left of the labor movement would be nothing short of disastrous, I think. If the recent experience of AFSCME in Wisconsin is any guide, we should expect to see a substantial portion of our membership base evaporate more or less overnight. AFSCME affiliates in that state lost roughly 60% of their membership in the year after Act 10 was passed, and they've lost tens of millions of dollars in dues and fees. It's not just the agency shop that's under attack. In 2011, Tennessee abolished exclusive representation for teachers. Today, teachers in Tennessee may choose to be part of the traditional teachers union, they can be part of a professional association, they can be part of nothing if they choose. And that kind of system has been more or less copied in the VW plant in Chattanooga that the UAW and Volkswagen have implemented there. Outside of Tennessee, conservative forces are pushing a right-to-work ballot initiative in Oregon, which would ostensibly balance the loss of agency shop with the ending of exclusive representation. So like I said before, the legal institutional framework that's been in place for decades, that we've basically been taking for granted this whole time, is being dismantled, and we're gonna have to figure out how to operate on a radically new terrain. We're also going to have to figure out how to contend with the likely responses of rival currents within the labor movement to the changes that are being forced upon us. So I kind of see three primary strategic and tactical responses that those currents are arguing for. One is labor management partnership. Two is the shift of focus from workplace-based organizing to PR strategies and electoral legislative maneuvering. Third is the adoption of what I consider to be problematic alternative sources of funding. So first, labor management partnership. The Chicago-based labor lawyer and writer Thomas Gagin lays out a provocative vision of a new labor movement in his new book. It's called Only One Thing Will Save Us. I think it's for sale in the other room. Like many other left liberals, he's enamored of the West European welfare states, the German model of stakeholder capitalism in particular. The book is replete with praise for the system of co-determination, under which workers have the right to elect representatives to works councils and have a say over certain aspects of company policy. Can I have a moment, please? Just to get some water. I'm hopped up on caffeine, sorry.
I'm jealous.
So according to Gagin, the labor movement shouldn't aim to reform labor law, which he thinks is proven to be all but impossible, but rather it should move to amend corporate governance policy. And in this way, companies will be held accountable not just to their stakeholders, but to their employees, to their shareholders, but to their employees and other stakeholders as well. But it's difficult to view this kind of German model as the wave of the future for US labor when employers are giving up on it in Europe. As the German economy shifts from manufacturing to services and from larger firms to smaller ones, works council representation and collective bargaining coverage is steadily decreasing. New companies and growing industries don't want to deal with unions or works councils, and so far they've been rather successful in resisting them. As a result, Germany's experienced something of a strike wave in recent years. The ongoing work stoppages at Amazon distribution centers are only the most conspicuous example. There were 367 strikes in Germany in 2012. In 2013, that figure spiked to 1,384. In response, the Merkel government, with the healthy assist from the Social Democrats, recently passed a bill that restricts the ability of certain unions, specifically those outside the main trade union confederation, to engage in strikes and other forms of industrial action. In addition, the low-wage sector in Germany has exploded. Their whole model is based on wage repression, all the rest of it. Left liberals should know better than to embrace this model as something to be emulated, but they continue to hold it up. Besides, US workers and their unions have already had ample experience with imported models based on labor management partnerships, and it's been a total disaster. The Japanese auto transplants, for example, brought lean production, quality circles, and other practices that have only served to increase the exploitation of workers under the partnership, under the guise of partnership and jointness. The UAW in particular committed itself to this strategy in the 1980s, and it's only brought the union closer to the employers while imposing massive concessions, above all the two-tier wage structure on the membership. As the Canadian labor activist Sam Gindin has argued, the partnership approach leads unions to identify with their employers, quote, their employers, and to place the competitiveness of the company above the well-being of the rank and file. As a result, unions and workers are drawn to a terrain, strengthening corporations and prioritizing competitiveness, which undermines the very independence from capital and the priority of capitalist accumulation unions emerge to challenge. That's a quote from Gindin. So this kind of advocacy of labor management partnership naturally leads people like Gagin and others to argue that employers shouldn't be the primary target of the labor movement. He says in his book, to go up against employers with the idea of bringing labor back is futile. Labor is just too weak, far too weak. Be it a Caterpillar or a Ford, the other side can crush us. If that's the point of striking McDonald's or Macy's or Subway or Walmart, i.e. to beat employers directly, I fear the worst. So instead, he argues that we should pressure politicians, change public opinion so that through PR and other kinds of public actions, so that they perceive the country as ungovernable, and they do things like change the law to make it easier for workers to get representation on boards. This is all predicated on his particular reading, peculiar reading of 20th century labor history, which privileges the actions of politicians and state managers over working class self-activity. So consider his description of labor law, of New Deal labor law reform. He says, there was no labor movement that knocked down the door to get this kind of radical change. It came from middle-class progressives, the great-grandparents of those who graduate from the Kennedy School today. This is absurd. It completely leaves out the great wave of worker upheaval that swept the U.S. from 1933 to 1937, which really did threaten to make the country ungovernable and made politicians think twice about calling out the National Guard. And their main target wasn't politicians or congressional staffers or thought leaders, it was the boss. The fast food and retail worker actions are inspiring and necessary, but as Jane McAlevey has argued, they aren't strikes just because someone spelled them S-T-R-I-K-E-S. Unlike the Chicago Teachers Union strike of 2012, and if you're a CTU member in the crowd, let me give you a round of applause. They don't directly target the boss, and they haven't succeeded in doing what strikes are supposed to do, stop production. Gagin repeatedly praised the CTU strike, but he misses its biggest lesson. Workers can successfully influence politics only if they have control over their own organizations and can exercise collective power on the job. This is obviously not to say that influencing politics or public policy is unimportant, but for too long, unions have undervalued the crucial need to build strong organizations in the workplace itself. By prioritizing PR and electoral legislative maneuvering, we've cut ourselves off from our biggest source of potential power, our own members, who will only gain the capacities necessary to exercise leadership in wider political struggles through direct action against their bosses on the shop floor. This has long been the soft underbelly of trade unionism in the US, and it's been exposed for all of us to see in the current anti-union offensive. Third, funding sources. With the agency shop under attack, official labor has begun the search for alternative sources of funding for its political and other activities. Some of you may have seen this, what I think is a pretty remarkable article in Politico that came out like a week ago, that details the efforts of the AFL-CIO to solicit funding from wealthy liberals, including the hedge fund billionaires George Soros and Tom Steyer. According to the article, six international unions have joined a donors club called the Democracy Alliance, including the American Federation of Teachers, the Communications Workers, SEIU, and the United Food and Commercial Workers. Fortunately, I don't think my union's part of this, which is good. All of the affiliate unions are required to make an annual dues payment of $60,000 to the alliance in return for access to the network of liberal big money donors. Working America, the AFL-CIO's community-based membership organization, has been a major focus of these fundraising activities. Excuse me. As the article points out, the group was started in 2003 by the AFL-CIO, which originally provided 93% of its funding. But by 2013, the most recent year for which we have records, the AFL-CIO and other unions contributed only 40% of the $25 million raised by Working America and the Working America Education Fund. These two arms are registered under sections of the tax code that don't require them to disclose their donors, end quote. The rest of that article goes on to explain how far labor-oriented nonprofits have gone in recent years to raise money from foundations and wealthy donors. Some people might ask, what's wrong with that? Isn't more money for projects like Working America a good thing? Simply put, it's not free money. By taking money from hedge fund billionaires and other wealthy donors, unions and labor nonprofits will also have to accept, to some degree, the priorities and the ideology of turning the labor movement into just another NGO with all the problems and limitations that plague other forms of foundation-funded activism. So my conclusion. Most of the talk has been fairly critical and pessimistic, but I want to end on an optimistic note. There's no doubt that the potential loss of agency shops the unions that remain to do lots of things very differently, and to put a premium on building strong workplace-based organizations so that the remaining members that we have see the value in paying dues voluntarily. Above all, we should not accept the notion that the loss of voice suck, so workers will always organize, even in the absence of legal rights and state comps to participate. Institutions aren't permanent, but workers into a new upsurge of worker organization. Prospects for worker self-activity may currently look bleak. Divided as they were by race, ethnicity, language, national origin, etc., had no hope of organizing themselves to fight powerful companies like GM, but they did it anyway. So then is now a new layer ourselves for that upsurge when it comes.
That was Chris Misano, Staff Radio. Next up, Larry Bradshaw.
I want to thank Chris and Melissa for those great presentations. And the fighting spirit of Socialism 2015 is a well-boring statistics of and depressing statistics about the decline of labor. So I cut to the chase. And what I tell people is, look at me, I look old, don't I? I'm probably one of the oldest people in the room. Being old is not a bad thing. But American unions have been declined since. Oh, you're in trouble when your enemies start limiting how weak you are. And when your former adversaries come in the world, you need more unions. I'm serious. A remarkable conclusion that when you bust unions, the poor get poorer, the rich get richer. But it's actually good information there, because what it does is it shows that you can attribute half of the enemies. They then go on to note, well, then the rich then get to use this money to manipulate the economic and political system. Now, seriously, the IMF, which is one of the key organizing bodies of the international capitalist class, says if you want to decrease these, the IMF has not turned over a new leaf. The loan conditions at the sharp decreases in trade union organization and collective bargaining. Clinton coming to our aid. Remember, Clinton and Reich came to elect Bill Clinton, and we would win labor law reform. And labor law reform, the same thing they told us about Jimmy Carter for Hillary, to try to get us to vote for Hillary. Now, Reich study group, and he was quoted as saying, the jury is out on whether the traditional union is still necessary for the new workplace. So now Reich produces a very popular YouTube video on the importance of unions. So when Reich and the International Monetary Fund come to the defense of trade unions, we know we're in serious trouble. And now we have this about. Just to add a couple is, Supreme Court says you can't force compelling political speech. But in the public sector, they say a union, a designated bargaining unit for a particular group of workers. So they have to represent all workers, whether you're union or non-union. So this creates a free rider problem, right? You can get the benefits of a union without having to pay union dues. So the compromise that was struck by the Supreme Court back in 1977 in a case called Abood versus the Detroit Board of Education is that unions can charge an agency or union agreement clause, which requires non-members to pay a fee to the union for the cost of representation. So this came out in the period of the 1970s, which was a huge time of labor upsurge and turmoil in this country, where you had millions of public sector workers flooding into unions. You had strikes had increased from 1 million in 1965 to up to 2.5 million by 1971. And you had rank and file opposition groups that were leading wildcat strikes. So the Supreme Court actually in their decision on Abood says, unions may need to do this to create an orderly workplace, to create labor peace. And so that was sort of the trade-off, is to sort of entrench a union into a certain position and let them sort of control the workforce. So this began to change with the number of court cases that Chris talked about. The 9 Supreme Court justices saying that they believe the Abood, and essentially the last decision last year, Justice Alito in particular was saying, somebody, please, anybody, bring us a case that gives us whatever you bargain for is political. Whether you're bargaining for a smaller class size if you're a teacher, whether you're bargaining for a wage increase, these are public resources. So if you're a union member and you disagree with the union, by forcing you to pay union dues to contribute to a union for a speech they don't agree with, you're compelling their speech. So you can see the setup. I agree with Chris. I'll raise you a dollar, and I will say that I will almost virtually guarantee they will overturn Abood. So politicians have the scorched earth approach. They steal our pensions, they cut our health care, they demonize us, they demonize our pensions, they demonize the public services that we provide. And now union organization itself is under judicial and legislative attack across the country. So what does our side do in response? Not much. Right. So if you're like the country, knew that the Abood decision was coming down. They didn't know what case it would be, flooding the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Where was the multicolor demonstration on the mall? You know. So I think part of my problem is I think we all have this tendency. I know I'm often guilty of viewing the social world through a medical or a scientific prism. So you'll hear me and you'll hear nurses say things like, the economy is sick, or income inequality is unhealthy, or we'll compare capitalism to a disease, right? But if you listen to a socialist, say, who's a mechanic who works near the water, they're gonna use nautical metaphors, they'll chip around, and listen to the choice of metaphors they use to describe social and fight or flight response. I think most people know what that is. So well, it's a nervous system response. It starts in your brain. It primes you for fleeing or for fighting. Your brain produces this hormone of this cascade of hormones, the most common being adrenaline, which increases your heart rate, raises your blood pressure, prepares you for either running from the danger or fighting for the danger. Our union officials to have this sort of same fight. And now I do have an understanding, a Marxist understanding of the trade union bureaucracy. I know unions, lots of other perks. They enjoy job security in a way. They're removed from the shop floors, from all the pressures that are there, and also from the fellowship of their coworkers. They're sent to a very different environment of an office, or they're constantly closeted away with management in negotiations. So they become, so therefore, I understand that they're probably going to be the last people, right, or to break an injunction, to run and retreat, right, the flight part of fight or flight. But I must admit, I was perplexed in Wisconsin, and then Indiana, and then Michigan. Remember, right-to-work laws mean the drying up of the union treasury, right? So you would think when the union organization itself is under attack, this is the time when our union officials are going to threaten to get out of hand with the teacher strike or the calls for adjournment fines in the state house to lobby in to recall the Democratic Party through the wrong lens, the lens of flight or flight. So I read, and it's titled The Unthinkable, Who Survives Disaster When Disaster Strikes. She studied how the brain responds in these situations. Now, it turns out there's another element to fight or flight. It's fight, flight, or freeze. That it turns out that very common human reaction, and the brain has problems in processing the sudden appearance, you're going to die. Now, she gets some very compelling, some tragic, cannot rely upon the old patterns of normalcy. And when they're confronted with something the likes of which they've never seen before, this old way, by the 1948 agreement between after years of massive